Thank you, Christopher. And thank you, Mark Tay, for inviting me to come and speak to you here. I always love coming here and being with you, and such a lovely service, such lovely hymns that we've sung. As Christopher hinted, there's going to be some audience participation because I gave this talk about an hour and a half ago at Alden in an all-age worship, and we normally have a little bit of interaction in our all-age worships. Now, every year, there's a magazine called Time. I'm sure you've seen it at airports and stations and news agents with a big red rectangle around the picture on the front. And every year, it has an issue which features Who Matters Most. And it publishes 100 names each year of people who have mattered most that year. Interestingly, back in 2005, one of the 100 people who mattered most was John Stott, who I'm sure most of us will know from his writing, and perhaps we've been to missions that he's been involved in and so on. But that was interesting. But this year's Who Matters Most was rather less interesting than that. In fact, I knew very few of the names. I don't blame that on Time. I blame that on me. But the ones I did recognize were people like Barack Obama, Warren Buffett, who was used to come second in the Who Earns Most, the Rich Man Stakes, to Bill Gates, didn't he? Hillary Clinton was there. And there was one British name that I recognized, and that was Kate, Duchess of Cambridge. So I thought we'd do a little bit of Who Matters Most here in Mark's Tay. And I've asked three important people if they would come up here and just be briefly interviewed. I'm going to need a microphone for this. Could I borrow one of these? I think. Thank you. They've not. Come on, Andrew, Mark, and thanks, and Helen. Would you like to just come forward? It went down awfully well at all. Right, Helen, could I start with you? Helen, I've known you for quite a while, and Helen was terribly important. I mean, Helen was involved in getting Ian and Jane here. You do realise that, don't you? You remember all those years ago? But anyway, why are you important, Helen?
That's an awfully difficult question. I'm a wife and mother. I'm important to my
family.
That's
right, yes.
In my job, I'm a teacher, so I have influence on quite a few children, so I have to be a bit careful there as to how I behave.
A very responsible job, I imagine.
It is responsible,
yes.
It is. Yeah. I mean, I'm a child of God. that's what I really think I'm important, but I can't not say that.
No, that's fine.
Yes, fine.
I think it's your teaching that must be, in the eyes of the world anyway, a very, very important thing to be doing. Well done. Good. Let's move on a bit. Another teacher, Mark, you're a teacher, aren't you?
Yep.
But a bit more than that in the church. Why are you important?
Husband to Isabel. she runs the house, cooks all the food.
Jolly.
Eat the food. Father to Naomi and Peter, I'm grumpy father with them and usual kind of stuff with teenagers. Murthy over in India, we sponsor through Compassion. I like to think I'm quite important to him.
I come across you mostly in providing music here. Is that important?
Yep.
Yeah. Good.
Very important.
Yeah. When I interviewed our musician at Alden, we are totally dependent on Anne. I know you've got plenty of musicians here, so it's not quite so vital, but it's very important, leading music, leading the worship. And so, come to Andrew now. I've known Andrew for more years than I can remember. Why are you important, Andrew?
I don't think I am, really.
Come on.
I just feel I'm very blessed with quite a few gifts and talents, and I just try and use them, that's all.
Yeah, but you use them in all sorts of ways, but in one particular way, you use them to help keep this building in a very nice state, don't you?
I've been sort of looking after the fabric of the church and the hall since 86, which I think is, I try and make the building serve us rather than us serve the building. And one of my blessings at work is I actually also go around and look at other churches, probably 50 to 60 churches over a 5-year period. I go around. I did one this last week at Brentwood, big URC church. And that's just a nice bit to add a bit, give a bit back to God and to God's people. And I just feel that I just try and use my life to give bits back wherever I can.
Well, I bet the church wardens regard you as being very important, don't you? As they formally have responsibility for the fabric, but I'm sure it's in practice in your hands. Well, thank you very much, all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, we could do what Time magazine did, and we could now have a vote and try and put these people in order of importance, couldn't we? And I'm sure you've all got in mind, I hope you've all got in mind, who you think of these three actually is the more important, have you? I'm not going to ask you, but I'm sure you've thought about it somehow or other. Well, we won't waste time on conducting a poll at this stage. But one of the things that does come out from this is that three people we've chosen more or less at random all have different kinds of gifts and are all important in different ways. And as most have hinted, they all feel that they are important to God. Now, in the reading, which we had dramatized, and by the way, well done. I thought the drama was done extremely well. I hope you got the gist of what I'm just going to highlight from it now. That was very well done. In fact, Jesus encountered in that drama two very, very different people. And they could hardly have been more different. The first one was a man. Do we remember his name? Jairus, that's right. And why was he important? You'd have to listen extremely carefully to pick this up from the... Why was he important? He was a ruler or a leader in the synagogue. So he was the local rector, maybe even the local archdeacon, I don't know. But he was pretty important. And he was a man, and his need was pretty clear in the drama, wasn't it? What was his need? His daughter was close to death, wasn't it? She was close to death. May even have been thought to have died during the drama. And then in the middle of this, Mark interrupts the story of Jairus with another healing. And this time it's a woman that comes along. What was her name? We don't know. We're not even told her name. Her problem, if you have read the notice sheets or you know the story, was that she was bleeding. And how long had she been bleeding? Do you remember from this? 12 years. And she was penniless. Not because she'd wasted her money. Do you remember what she'd spent it on from the story? She'd spent it on doctors' fees to try and heal her from this bleeding. Blood was worried about in those days. She was ritually unclean. And anyone that touched her because of this bleeding would also be unclean. So it's no wonder the doctors were a bit scared of her. And perhaps that's why they put their prices up. But they hadn't been able to do anything. And because of her uncleanness, she was regarded as an outcast. If Jairus was up near the top of the social scale, she was right down at the bottom. To get an idea of how Jewish society in those days treated someone like this woman, you need to read Leviticus chapter 15. And we're not going to do it now, but I suggest you have a look at that perhaps when you get home or tonight. Have a look at Leviticus chapter 16 and see what the conditions were and what the rules were for people with those kind of illnesses in those days. And if you thought that contagion was something that was a sort of domino effect that affects banks and the euro and the Greek economy and so on, just listen to this extract from Leviticus 19, 15. A woman is regarded as unclean during her monthly period for a minimum of 7 days. So is anything she touches, and anyone who touches anything that she has touched, and so on. But if she has a discharge of blood other than her period, she is unclean throughout the discharge and for a further period of 7 days. And the rules of contagion always contain this 7 days. So it's no wonder the doctors didn't get very far trying to treat her. No wonder she was penniless. She'd suffered a great deal, it says, under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. At this point, things were going through my mind about Leviticus 15. I was a bit angry. I thought, you know, why should somebody like this be outcast? Somebody who needs help be cast out? Is this punishment by an angry God? And, you know, a lot of people outside there, when they look at the Bible and they want to pick holes in the Bible and pick holes in our faith, a lot of them will go to Leviticus and find things there which they don't like and which don't seem to apply to today. But these rules in Leviticus 15 were not vengeance from an angry God. They were essentially rules of hygiene in an era when people did not really understand biology or genetics or any of those things. And by today's standards, it may seem that they are a bit over the top, but better be safe than sorry. Now, also in Leviticus 15 are rules for what happens if you get diarrhea. It doesn't actually use the word. It doesn't actually try and spell it. It is a difficult word to spell, isn't it? Diarrhea is a symptom of a highly infectious typhoid or cholera. And if somebody gets that, they need to really be isolated until it has passed. And so these rules are essentially, in Leviticus 15, are rules of hygiene, over the top rules of hygiene, because the people did not know and could not have known, really, what we know today. And the other thing about blood is that we now know today that blood is a carrier of infection. And so anyone with an issue of blood is effectively infectious. And so that is another reason why she was expected to keep away from everybody else, even though it had gone on for 12 years. Just think about the people, though, that the woman must have touched as she barged through the crowd to get to Jesus. They would all be infected. They would all be ritually unclean. So it's not surprising that the crowd would not have been too pleased if they'd really known what was going on. And if the crowd had had to vote between Jairus and the woman as to who was the most important, I don't think there's any doubt in my mind as to which way the crowd would have voted. But Jesus didn't. Jesus' vote was that these two people were equal in his sight. And as you know from the story, both the Jairus' daughter and the woman were both healed by Jesus. Big contrast between the two main actors in the story. There's another contrast between the two of them, and it's the question of big problems or little problems. You see, a little girl dying is a huge, huge problem. People who've suffered under the death of a child will know that far, far better than I can tell. It's a terrible thing. Death can't be reversed. So that problem, Jairus's family faced a huge problem, a tragedy that would affect them for the rest of their lives. He needed all the healing power that he could get from Jesus. Big, big problem. The woman, on the other hand, had a chronic condition. She'd lived with it for 12 years. It probably wasn't life-threatening. She might still live or just about exist at the bottom of the social scale for another 12 years. And I reckon if Jairus had known what her problem was, he would have probably said, oh, it's trivial compared with mine. And incidentally, the woman shares in this sense of proportion. She doesn't really want to trouble Jesus. She doesn't want Jesus to have to lay hands on her. Otherwise, he'd be infected. He'd be an outcast. He'd be ritually unclean. No, she didn't want that. She didn't even want Jesus to visibly pray for her or cast spirits out or whatever. Just to touch her coat. His coat. That was all she wanted. Such was her faith. But it is important that one of these two had a huge problem, and compared to that, the other one had a relatively minor problem. So we come to ourselves, we come back into the 20th century, and we see ourselves, and what do we have to learn from this story? Well, I think there are two things. One is about importance, and the other is about the size of our problems. So, who do you think are really important people in the world today? Who was watching television last night? Oh, yes. So, who do you all think was important last night, up till about 2 minutes past 11? Who was really important? Who was really important? Andy Murray was really important, wasn't he? He's a celebrity of sport. But of course, celebrities infect every other aspect of society, the pop industry, TV, film, and so on. And I guess that Jairus was a bit of a celebrity in Galilee, being an important man in the synagogue. But it's important, isn't it, to see that Jesus' attitude to people of totally different importance is a long way from the world's attitude to importance. In the world out there, if you want to get on in your life, in your career, right, you've got to have a good helping of self-importance. You've got to have a lot of self-confidence if you want to get on out there. That's how the world sees it. I'm not saying the world is wrong, but it's how the world actually sees our importance. You have to groom yourself so that your peers and your potential employers think you're important. If you have the misfortune to be in the business of selling things for a company, then you've got to sell yourself so that you can sell their products. That's how the world of employment sees you as important. How well do you sell our products or our services? But what about us? And what about Jesus? What did Jesus say was important? Did he ever say we had to sell ourselves? Sell goods for the people that we work for? Or is it something else that we should be selling? Well, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said to the crowd who listened, "You are the light of the world." He was saying, you have to shine with my light in this dark world. He's calling us to sell the light of Jesus, to promote the light of Jesus, to promote the truth about Jesus, to promote the truth about his life and death and resurrection. That's what Jesus calls us to do. That's what Jesus thinks is important. Paul picked this up as well, and he said, quite a long time after the resurrection, now you, who he's writing to, are the body of Christ. You who are followers of Christ have got to adopt his values and his attitude to importance and his attitude to people, his attitude to the care of people in need. James, in his letter, is very, very explicit about this, and he chooses an example how people behave in church. Now, I'm sure this does not apply to you at all, but I want you to think, what is an example similar to this? Because James said, my brothers, as believers in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ, don't show favoritism. And the example he gives is this. Suppose a man comes into your meeting wearing a gold ring and fine clothes. That certainly excludes me. And a poor man in shabby clothes also comes in. Now, if you show special attention to the man wearing the fine clothes and say, here's a good seat for you, but say to the poor man, oh, you can stand there at the back, or you can sit down round the corner there, somewhere other out of the way. If you do that, then you've discriminated among yourselves, and you've become judges with evil thoughts. Discrimination, depending, based on appearance. Think whether you, that there is another example in your own lives that might apply to. James, I'm sure, had more than just the discipline in his local church in mind. So the lesson of importance, what is really important in people? Not what they appear to be, not what the world thinks, but what Jesus thinks, that everyone is important in his sight, so everyone should be important in our sight. The other way that the two people, the woman and Jairus, contrasted was in the size of their problems. Now, I can tell you that it's much easier in a real crisis in your life to throw yourselves on Jesus and on God than it is when small things crop up. I mean, about 17 years ago, when I had cancer, I just felt I had to throw myself entirely on Jesus and on God. And I remember the day we heard about it. Where's Phyllis? Coming to your prayer meeting, remember, and told you all that I got cancer, and it was at Mark's Tay where the group first of all prayed for us. And I felt like the psalmist at that time, that we were being lifted up as on eagle's wings above our troubles. And that's as it should be. The difficulty comes when we have small troubles, like that boot full of economics books. Small troubles. And do we take those to the Lord? I think the story, the message from this story is that the woman's relatively small problem of bleeding, right, was dealt with by Jesus in exactly the same way as Jairus' daughter. Jesus said, you may ask me for anything in my name and I will do it. He doesn't say just big things, but he also says little things as well. But there is a slight word of warning here, and I feel, in asking God to do things. There's a danger, I think, in trivializing what we might call supplicatory prayer and praying for absolutely everything. And sometimes this ends up demanding the right kind of weather for me throughout the day, demanding that I find a parking place for my car, preferably a free one, Lord. Or a quick prayer that my team is going to win as I walk onto the football field, or that I might score. People that I hope that people who pray these kind of what I might call me prayers would also include a wider range of what we might call others' prayers as well. Because Jesus qualified that invitation to ask anything in his name by the following. He said, "And I will do whatever you ask in my name, so that the Son may bring glory to the Father." So to conclude, Jesus healed both Jairus' daughter and the woman who was bleeding. The big problem and the small problem. The important man's problem and the less important person's problem. All credit, though, to Mark. Not this Mark here, I'm afraid, but Saint Mark, who wrote the Gospel. Because he put the woman's case in what you might call a Jairus sandwich. If you read the inside of your service sheets when you get home, you'll see that the woman is a block inside the healing of Jairus' daughter. It's sometimes called a Markan sandwich, and there are one or two other examples of this in Mark's gospel. He could easily have taken these out and put them in as two separate incidents. And had he done that, we might not have spotted what he was really saying here was that, look, think about the contrasts. They're important. And the way he forces that on us is by putting the one story inside the other story. That makes the point that all people are equally important to God. Problems big or small can be brought to him. So we, as the body of Christ here, we're commissioned with carrying on a ministry of care and healing to all people, regardless of their position, and of bringing the love of God to people with problems, big or small. And as I wrote those words, I'm virtually finished now, I was reminded of words in the Book of Common Prayer, which introduces some of its intercessions with words for all sorts and conditions of men, and of course, women. Thank you. Should we just pray?